Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
Welcome back to the show, team. My name's Amelia, and today we have another really awesome guest on the show. We have Ingrid, who is a Chief Operating Officer with Rad Innovate. Welcome to the show, Ingrid.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm so excited. We're fancy enough to have two COOs come on the show. So cool.
We're replicating out there.
They can only be for the good. So starting off with what is probably going to be a very broad question, but what is your job?
So Chief Operating Officer of Rad Innovate, and the full title of that is it's an ARC, which is funded by the Australian Research Council, Industrial Transformation Training Centre, which is a mouthful as well, for radiation innovation. So Rad Innovate, this is not my job, but the place that I work is set up to be a collaborative endeavour. We've got three universities, ANU, University of South Australia, University of Adelaide, working together, and what we'll have is PhDs and masters by research students working together on co-design, working on co-designed projects with industry and in the realm of radiation and nuclear science. So my job is to manage the centre. So do everything that's not the science, really. Herd the cats, as I like to call them, herd the researchers. So at the moment we're setting up the centre. We're getting all of our industry partners. We've got 16 of them, and we need to get them all to sign off and say, yep, we're going to take on students. We're going to give you the money that we wanted, that we promised. And then when the centre's all set up, I run the thing. So I'll do everything that's not science. So set up the website, set up social media and post on it, manage the finances, get financial reports and see how we're tracking, talk to our industry partners on a regular basis, organise, advertise for students, liaise with the academic student admin people, to make sure that they all get enrolled properly at their unis, that they're working together with their industry partners. We also do a lot of training for them. So we run meetings where they can give talks, but they also get training in things like science communication and community engagement. So it's a pretty cool endeavour.
It sounds huge, but like the endeavour itself sounds huge. Your role sounds quite diverse and very interesting.
Yeah, so one of the things I like about COOs is, and that sort of role, whether it's in, so previous to this, I was at Astro 3D, which is a centre of excellence, same but different. So that's got less industry involvement, more scientific research. But the cool thing about these jobs is that I think they're best if they're run by someone who likes science and appreciates the science. You don't have to be the scientist. You have to, I've always said, understand enough just to be dangerous. So understand what they're trying to achieve with their science. And you get to learn a whole heap of stuff. Like I know more astrophysics than I could ever imagine that I would have if I hadn't, you know, given that I haven't studied astrophysics. I'm also learning now a lot about radiation and all the different aspects of how that's used in industry and nuclear science and things like heavy ion accelerators. It's fun to enable that and be a part of something that enables those really interesting science and industry linkages to go ahead.
Yeah. And it's always like lovely being surrounded by people who are smart and energetic about their work as well.
100%. So like one of the jobs that I used to do was I was a travel agent. And one of the reasons I stopped being a travel agent, apart from the fact it's really crappy money and working really, really hard and stressful, is that they weren't my people. You know, if you talked something about science, maybe it was just the people I was working with, but that, you know, they didn't appreciate that. But, you know, whereas I really like working with really smart, intelligent people. I'm not saying that people who travel agents aren't. They don't necessarily nerd out about the science in the way that, you know, I would.
No, it's just a very different.
It's a different dynamic, and I prefer this one.
Is it okay if I ask you a couple of questions about, like, radiation?
Sure.
I guess this is like a quick quiz on what you've learned so far.
Yeah.
But radiation, my understanding is that we've known about radiation for a while.
Yep.
How much is there that we still need to innovate?
So there's certainly here at ANU, so out behind me is the Heavy Ion Accelerator, which is like an amazing piece of kit. And they do a lot of fundamental basic nuclear physics research there. And a lot of it now is moving towards things like quantum. Now, I won't even pretend to understand quantum, and I don't know really what qubits are, but they're a thing that they use in computing, and they're really fast. And so, for instance, that fundamental understanding of the nuclear science has now morphed into a company that we're working with, Quantum Brilliance. And what they do is they implant nitrogen atom into diamonds, into something called a vacancy. There's a space or something in diamonds, and that helps create a qubit that they use in quantum computing, so which enables us to do, you know, really fast computing. That's my very lay level understanding of that. So the link between fundamental basic research, we're still learning more new things and how to do new things, and with the accelerators, and then that is very often translatable to industry and research. I think the interesting thing, having gone from a centre that which was really fundamental science, like astrophysics, there's no necessarily obvious outcome for that apart from new knowledge and understanding how the universe works. However, you know, from astrophysics, we've got Wi-Fi, we've got CCDs, the charge-coupled devices in our cameras that we now carry around in our phones. We've got, you know, all sorts of radio waves and, you know, so many innovations in our everyday life. GPS comes from fundamental basic physics research, whether that's astrophysics, nuclear physics, there's some other physics things that I haven't worked in, but yeah. So it's really, there's the fact that we're just learning new knowledge, but there's also the fact that one day some of this stuff, you know, you talk about relativity, things like that, that actually could be used in ways that we could never comprehend.
And it's sort of, it's a chicken and egg thing as well. Yeah. As technology improves, like we need the hardware that's able to keep up. And,
yeah, absolutely. Sort of. And you know, we see that here at the Heavy Ion Accelerator. So that's kept up with the technology, has kept up with the research, and they keep pushing it to do more and more. And they've just recently added a space beam line. So it's some, the ions come down out of the accelerator and go along these beam lines. And this one's specially set up, don't ask me how, but it is specially set up to test things that are going to go into space. So, you know, they can test the impact on computers or shielding or different aspects of satellites or things that are going to go into space. How is the radiation in space going to affect that over time?
That it seems a lot more sensible and somewhat cheaper than sending it up and then
absolutely saying, well, yes, it's much better to figure out, and they can do a lot of theoretical modeling as well, so they get a little bit of data and they can, you know, this is my understanding, expand that and, you know, extrapolate that information and do quite complex modeling to see how these things are going to last over time. Yet much cheaper than sending up and going, oh yeah, that doesn't work anymore. Or, you know, stops working after a year because of the radiation.
Which is fair. But because my next question was going to be, like, why would you ever need to accelerate a heavy ion?
So they do it for a range of things, and this is my limit of my scientific knowledge here. But they're irradiating seeds to get rid of germs and things like that. They do all this space testing, so of the equipment. They are doing fundamental research into... So one of the other cool things that we're looking at is that one company is taking tailings from a uranium mine and they're turning radioactive tailings. So they're cleaning that up by getting the tailings and changing them into products that are used that give off alpha particles, which are little helium atoms, and those alpha particles are targeted cancer treatments. So one of the troubles with these targeted cancer treatments is that they don't have enough of the raw product to create. They can, I don't know how, but they turn the lead and radium, well, do they turn the radium into lead or something like that, plutonium into radium. I don't know, something like that. I can look it up for you and find
something
out.
Something gets transferred.
Find out which exact isotopes they turn from one thing to another that is actually useful, and then they use those useful instead of just sitting there and just giving off bits of radiation. They accelerate that process and turn it into very useful cancer treatments.
How do you even think of that?
I don't know. Like, you know, it's just... it's mind-blowing. And when you go and walk around this, you know, heavy ion accelerator, and I presume, you know, any other kind of accelerators and things that people have around the place. So, for instance, there's a place in Adelaide that it's a proton. I don't know. Don't ask me if it's a... I might get that technically wrong. What's it called? Is it a proton accelerator? It's doing something with protons, which are positively charged particles, as opposed to...
They're heavy as
heavy.
Well.
Heavy. Oh, I don't know. All this more I'm learning as I go along.
I'm asking you the hard questions.
I have only been here for 2 months, so bear with me.
Oh, right.
And, you know, and probably any of the scientists who might be listening going, no, she screwed it all up. It's wrong.
Well, they can come on the show.
Correct me. As a general, anyway, so they're doing stuff with developing better cancer treatments. Well, they will be when they've finally built and the thing is operational, which will be soon. Yep. So there's amazing stuff that's going on in terms of environmental remediation, tracking and tracing elements and isotopes. So, for instance, you can get dirt samples, basically. And so one of the things that Queensland Health is doing is getting these samples and from different parts of the catchment and figuring out what is causing runoff. Where is the runoff that's going into the Great Barrier Reef and, you know, dirt covering the Great Barrier Reef? Where's it coming from? And so for such a long time, we thought that was caused by runoff from sugarcane farming. And it turns out, no, it's actually riverbed and river erosion, which is originally my field of expertise, which is then caused by increased runoff and from catchments by clearing. So it's not technically runoff from the sugar cane. It's actually because these catchments have been cleared and the rivers are eroding, that's where the... and they can tell that from the isotopes that they test.
So it's like really clever detective work.
But using, you know, all this sort of fundamental particle physics stuff.
You mentioned there's like, it was around 17 or something.
Yeah.
Industry partners. Like that seems like a lot. It never would have occurred to me there was that many businesses working in the radiation space in Australia.
Yeah, so some of them are like people like BHP, and it will be monitoring radiation load for workers, so making sure they're not exposed to too much stuff. Some of them medical people and a lot of new startups and things as well, so not really big companies, some smaller companies. Some of them are new space companies, so Skycraft is originated in Canberra, but now they're all over the place, and they are looking at having, now let me think, I think they're at the moment they've got geostationary satellites up in space in low Earth orbit. And again, I probably got that wrong, but anyway. And what they want to do is make sure that those, and they're connecting to, so airlines are purchasing them, putting them into space so that they can have communications and aircraft tracking. And what they want is their own like autonomy to be able to do that and not relying on, you know, someone from India putting a satellite up, or so the airlines themselves are interested in purchasing this commercial product that tracks their own aircraft, but they need to make sure that they're going to work in space and not get killed over time in radiation. So I'm just trying to think what else we've got. The other interesting thing that we're doing is working on social license and regulatory frameworks. So in Australia, that's not particularly well developed because we just like, oh no, not nuclear. So that's working mostly with government organised. So some students might actually do a whole research project on, okay, so, you know, why is it that, yes, nuclear medicine's okay, that saves lives, either, you know, the treatment or the detection of cancer. That's okay, but, you know, other forms of nuclear, whether it's mining or something like, or using nuclear-powered submarines, for instance, which has now come about, we don't like that. So understanding what the difference is in people's thought processes, and then how can different departments or companies, whatever, what do they do in their messaging and their community engagement to help say, look, you know, it's okay, it's safe, and what's the best practice in terms of regulatory frameworks. So there's a whole bunch of things in terms of community engagement, science communication, and regulatory frameworks that people can do research on.
Yeah, that stuff gets a bit spicy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. But, you know, the important thing there is, like, you know, trying to understand community attitudes, best practice in terms of community engagement, and particularly also with Indigenous communities where some of this stuff is really impacting. What's the best practice in terms of engaging with elders and Indigenous communities on country? You can't just go out and say, hi, I'm from the government, it's all okay, just trust me. It doesn't really work like that.
No. No. And it's like, we're a country with a huge amount of uranium. Like,
yeah,
we kind of need to work out how to work with that,
yeah.
I guess, as a yeah. culture.
Mm. Yeah. And so, you know, what is our waste management regulatory framework? Do we have one? Does it need to be upgraded if we're going to start utilising some of these things and have things like, you know, nuclear-powered submarines?
I mean, it sounds useful to have like a full life cycle plan.
I tend to think so, yeah. Mm. I mean, obviously there are people in government working on this, but the other thing too is, you know, all those industry partners, is there's a massive workforce shortfall in terms of people who are trained in nuclear science and radiation science, and then who have experience in working in whatever that particular field is. So there's all these different, you know, mining and environment and health and medical, and we've got some very new people coming out, and we've got some older people who are ready to retire, and it's going to leave a huge gap. And all of a sudden, you know, the same, you know, we've got startups, we've got SMEs, we've got big companies, we've got government organisations all competing for the same limited pool of qualified, experienced people. So a huge workforce issue. And so, you know, we won't fix it with the training centre, but we will go some way towards providing qualified students with industry experience.
It's going to be quite a range of things. Yeah. I feel like you said you've been on the job for 2 months. You have picked up a lot in a very short period of time.
It's been fun. I've had to, because we're going out and meeting with industry partners. And so while I don't have to understand the science, we do have to explain, you know, outline what the centres are trying to achieve, so that the different partners get an understanding of, you know, the other partners in the centre and how we're all working together to achieve common goals. So, yeah, you sort of have to come up to speed reasonably well. I mean, I feel like, so my background is also, apart from being a travel agent, I've got a science teaching background. So learning all of those different aspects of the Australian science curriculum gives me a tiny bit of background knowledge in each sort of different areas that I've been working in. So you can come up to speed, you know, if you do a lot of reading and listening and watching, you can come up to speed reasonably quickly. But that's one of the fun things about these different centres, is there's so, and it, some of the science is so niche, really, really niche. And academics, I don't think, sometimes realise how niche they are.
Well, because they're reading papers that are about that topic, and they're going to conferences with the 12 other people who know about that thing globally. So
exactly.
You've got your own bubble.
So, you know, one of the good things about these, you know, industrial transformation training centres, but also, you know, centres of excellence, even though the science, like some of the, if you go and have a look at the ARC website and see what centres they've funded, some of the titles of them, just like, I don't even understand what that means. I'm pretty lucky, and most people have a rough understanding of what nuclear science is, or radiation, and what, you know, astrophysics is. But Some of the other ones are very, very niche. But I guess the, you know, the challenge there is to try and explain what it is that the researchers are doing and why it's of benefit.
Yeah.
And so yeah, lots of centres do have dedicated science communication staff. So, and it depends on their focus. Some focus on outreach, so outreach to the general public. Some focus on education programs, so coming up with tools and lesson plans and things that can help teachers teach that in schools. So, yeah, it just depends on the centre. And what their focus is. But there's a lot of really good science communication that goes on explaining what it is these centres do and why they are why we should use taxpayers' money, basically, to fund these research centres.
It sounds like that job is going to fall a bit on you, though.
Certainly in this. So training centres are a smaller budget over a shorter time frame. So we last for 5 years. And so that's a bit tighter in terms of like the amount of professional staff that we can employ to do these sorts of things. So I guess it's either a good thing or a bad thing the way you look at it. You know, if you're someone who gets bored really easily, this sort of role is great because you can be, you know, a strategic manager. You're interacting with different industry partners, you're interacting with different aspects of the university, and you learn how universities work and academics work. You also get, you know, experience in science communication. If you want to, you can set your own website up. You can save a lot of money if you do it yourself and not pay someone to do it. You set, you know, you work out your own social media schedule, and then, you know, work out your own program of science communication. You've got finance, you've got KPI collection, you've got event management, so when you're organising conferences and meetings, you get to do a bit of everything, which is one of the cool things about these jobs.
Yeah. You could get overwhelmed, but...
Yeah. And like for some centres, it's very much a business development type focus, and other, you know, and some centres will have translational and commercialisation focus, so there'll be a widget or a thing or something that's particularly like in research hubs are more of like the thing that you sell at the end of it. So it's more about supporting universities to work in partnership with industry to create a commercialized thing. And it could just be knowledge, but it could also be a widget or, you know, a doodad, probably a really highly complex technical doodad, but, you know, whereas training centres really more about actually providing PhD students with industry experience and co-design projects. So that's the difference there. And centres of excellence are really about just supporting research. A lot of them have industry links and are doing translational type work as well, but there's some basic science ones as well. So it's a huge range of different science, technology, things that the ARC funds through all of these big grants.
Makes sense. Yeah. How did you get involved with this centre?
So I was working at the Canberra Innovation Network in the Inspiring Australia program. So that program is run by the federal government. It's housed out of Questacon. And it runs National Science Week, which is your main sort of big project that you work on. But the other part of it is to really build up a STEM network in whatever state you're working in. So I was working in Canberra in the ACT. So that was a great job. That was fun too. And I, you know, built this sort of network after moving to Canberra from the coast and knowing no one in the STEM area. By the time I left there sort of 3 years later, I knew lots and lots of people, and I was able to connect them together and create some really fun, exciting programs. And I had heard that, you know, that there was a job going up at Mount Stromlo for this new Centre of Excellence in Astrophysics, and they wanted an education and outreach and communications manager. And I went, that sounds like fun. I knew nothing about Centres of Excellence. I didn't know what they did. I didn't even know about how universities worked, and I didn't. It's embarrassing, but I didn't know the difference between a PhD student and a postdoc and you know, all the different academics levels and, you know, how that works. I didn't understand any of that. I thought I understood a little bit about astrophysics and a little bit about science and communication. Anyway, I got that job. And then later on I applied for and got the chief operating officer's role, which is a little less comm. Like, I was still able to sort of manage the communications and the education programs that we had. So I didn't completely leave it, but it just gave me the opportunity to sort of step up into that leadership role. So, yeah, so that's how I just moved up the hill from Canberra up to Mount Stromlo. So I was there for about 6 years doing supporting astrophysics. I wasn't doing the astrophysics.
Yeah. And so was this job just like advertised and you applied for it?
Yeah.
You're right.
So, you know, and that's the one of the things about, you know, yes, you can have a network, and like I wouldn't have known about the astrophysics job when I first, except a friend said, hey, you're going to apply for the, you know, it's Mount Stromlo job. I'm like, what are you talking about? And it really, it was a fun move. It was good. I wasn't looking particularly, but when I looked at it, I went, oh, that's too much fun not to apply for it. And so, yeah, so it's amazing what's out there when you actually start looking or asking, either one or both.
I feel like we've already covered a little bit of it, but what was your pathway from high school to here? Because I'm assuming you didn't know that there were CEOs of centres.
No, that wasn't my career goal. I didn't grow up thinking, when I grow up, I want to be a coup. No, I didn't even know. Yeah, I didn't even know these things existed. So I actually wanted to be an astronomer at one point there. I liked STEM and science. And certainly I think when I was in primary school, I did want to be an astronomer. And then I found out, it's really funny, like I found out all people said, you know, you need to have maths and physics and that's really hard. And like I was quite good at both those things. I don't know if I wasn't good enough. Or what I actually think happened is in like year 10 or so, like I got to the point where, you know, particularly mathematics was pretty easy up until year 10. And then in year 11 and 12, you know, it ramped up a bit. I found it much more difficult, but I don't think I really had the good study skills that I needed. So I expected it still to come pretty easily to me, and it was a bit tricky when it didn't. So I think actually if I had have had a little bit more, could have just been the right teacher or something, a little bit more assistance in developing up those study skills so that you can learn to persist when things get a bit difficult. It's not that I couldn't do them, it's just that I had to actually work at it. So I did reasonably well in, like, you know, year 12 in science and maths, physics, but not well enough to sort of, I'd given up being an astronomer by that point, but I certainly also then didn't become a physiotherapist or an optometrist, which is my other things that I was considering. So what I ended up doing was I went to university and I did a Bachelor of Science in Applied Physical Geography. So I was really enjoying geography at school at the time, and I was in New South Wales, and at that point they still had 3-unit geography, so you could do a higher level of geography, and I came first in that. And I really enjoyed not the urban planning and economic geography side of things, but I really liked things like river formation and how landscapes evolve and change over time. And so there was, and it doesn't exist anymore, a geography degree at University of New South Wales that did physical geography. So that's what I enrolled in. So I did my honours in that, and my honours thesis was downstream variations in modes of floodplain formation on Webbs Creek, which is a little tributary of the Hawkesbury River. So I dug lots of holes. I did lots of particle size analysis. I surveyed lots of creek cross sections. And I found that what had happened, it was a creek that was really laterally confined, so it didn't move sideways to form its floodplains. It formed its floodplains by vertical accretion, by dumping, because it couldn't move, it was stuck in this sandstone valley. It just dumped sand and formed its floodplains that way. But downstream, we had really fine particles. It wasn't formed by sand from the sandstone catchment. What had happened is as the sea level rose, it had dumped all of this marine sediment on top of the sand. And yeah, that was from sea level rising and then reducing down. So, yeah, so that's what I found in my honours thesis. I decided
that's
perhaps
so cool.
I didn't want to go and do a PhD, so I'm not Dr. Ingrid in fluvial geomorphology, is that freshwater stream formation. But I did end up working in government. So I worked for New South Wales Water Resources. And so utilising that knowledge of how rivers evolve and change over time and erosion control and things like that, I went and gave advice to landholders on how to stop riverbank erosion. We worked with sand and gravel extractors and gave them permits. So there's legislation that controls how much and how people can take sand and gravel out of rivers so we don't wreck them. So I worked with, you know, people like BHP, how the worm turns and comes around on their sand and gravel extraction permits. And so everything from little backyard operators to big operations like BHP, and I would go out and inspect the rivers and inspect their operations to make sure they were meeting their permit conditions. So, yeah, that was fun.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah. And then I sort of moved into what we would now call citizen science. So working instead of one landholder at a time, we worked on a project called River Care, which was a whole bunch of people, hopefully along a big stretch of the river or creek, waterway, working together to make sure that they improved, you know, the function of the stream or river, but also improved the biological and ecological functioning of it as well. So, you know, things like instead of planting willows, which has got a really great root system, but they have bad ecological impacts. So what's some other ways that we could utilise native plants and different types of engineering solutions to erosion problems? So work together with, and we come up with a plan of action, so a river care plan, but based on science. Yeah. And then I've started working in Streamwatch, which is water quality monitoring, so with either community groups or schools or things like that. And yeah, so that was all good fun. And I worked also over in Western Australia working on some of their publications on how community groups can best look after streams and rivers. So again, best practice and their version of Streamwatch over there.
This sounds, it all sounds quite fun, really.
Yeah, it is. And then I went and had some kids and followed my husband around the country a bit, doing where he was in IT, so he was doing different jobs. So that all sort of, yeah, so this is where I start my that was all pretty linear up to that point. And like, I didn't go into academia, but it was all pretty straightforward. So this is where I start my, what I call now, I used to call it a non-linear career, but just recently I heard the chief scientist say portfolio career.
Ooh.
I really like that.
She is on top of like... Right? The embracing of diversity.
Yeah. So
she gets it.
Yeah. So, you know, I've got straight science and I've got citizen science stuff. And so we actually ran our own business for a couple of years doing, it's up in Queensland, they call it management rights. So you purchase the right, you purchase the manager's unit in a complex of resort units, and you also purchase the right to manage and let the units on behalf of the unit holders. So I had to come up to speed and I learned all about, like, I did a certificate in real estate or something in Queensland to be able to manage this. And, you know, you had to learn how to run a business basically. And so we did that.
What a deviation.
I know. We're like, oh, I'm tired of working for the man, you know, let's go do something else. So I did that for a couple of years, but decided perhaps that it was just really hard with two young children. I have no idea what we were thinking. We're on drugs, man. It was really tricky. Like, you know, you had to be on it. We just really didn't think it through very carefully. You had to be on site, certainly in the places that we could afford to buy into, had to be on site 24/7. People would ring up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, they'd lock themselves out of their unit or, you know, oh, I've run out of alcohol. Do you guys sell alcohol? You know, yeah. Or, you know, you'd be, this is like the internet was still just in its infancy as well. So we would get phone calls from overseas trying to make a booking. So you had to sort of be there all the time on site to manage the property, but also manage all the lettings and the things. And it was insane. Like, even to go out to the grocery shops, someone had to still be on site. So we never did anything together.
I mean, there's obviously a lot of negatives, but it sounds like good, like, foundational organization.
Absolutely.
Project management. Exactly. Like, a lot of good skills.
Yeah, like, you know, that we're, you know, you're working in the tourism sector there. You're working also, you're providing services and things like, you know, liaising with different operators and stuff on tours and car hire and you name it. I learned a lot about running a business and just financial management of that and how to run, use different systems like booking systems and customer relationship, you know, software. I mean, all of it's now null and void and been overtaken by, you know, much better things. But, yeah, so one of the things I always say is, like, you can go off and do all these side trips, as I like to call them, and you might decide what's not for you. You might learn that, but I think in the process you always, always learn useful skills that you can translate. You know, I learned marketing skills there, marketing the property on behalf of the unit owners and, you know, running ads in newspapers. It sounds all very old-fashioned now, doesn't it?
Still happens.
Yeah, it does still happen. Yeah. They still exist. So, yeah, so, I mean, even though that didn't really work out, I'm glad that we did it. And so, and we ended up moving from, yeah, I'm getting my timeline in, right in my head, from Queensland down to the New South Wales South Coast. And we ran an electronics and music shop. It's a retail shop. So, yeah, just again, something completely new. My husband had like an IT background and, you know, knew enough about the electronics. It was like, it started off as a Dick Smith franchise type thing. And, and it ended up being, I think we ended up going independent, but yeah, through a different lot of buying groups. And so again, I learned how, you know, retail works and where you, you know, you purchase all your things for wholesalers and again, more marketing, you know, shop, what's it called when you put things on display, merchandising and, you know, stock management and how to, and even a little bit of entrepreneurship. Like, you know, when we first started, we were selling records, but we could see the writing was on the wall and that people were, you know, moving to CDs. And then later on, I think, you know, right towards the end, that people weren't even doing that and they were just downloading and streaming. So we got rid of that side of the music business and just sold musical instruments. So anyway, so that was fun. And while I was doing that, because I'm a glutton for punishment, I was also studying to become a teacher because the kids were young and I thought when they're ready to go to school, so will I be. So I studied to become a science teacher, and schools being what they are, I also taught mathematics in year 7 mathematics and the occasional, you know, year 8, 9, 10 class. And I also taught dance because I have a background in dance as well. Of course I do.
I love schools.
I know. And that was fun. I got to design whole units of work looking at the curriculum and just, like, design my own units of work on, you know, different practical aspects of dance and analysing dance and classical and jazz and tap and, you know, you name it. We did it. It was great fun.
What a ride.
Yeah.
That is
And then I ditched that and because my kids needed homeschooling. So this was before COVID, long before COVID. And so for quite a few years I homeschooled my kids. So I taught them everything, not just science and maths, but and dance. We did do. Neither of them are good dancers. But, you know, PE and art and poetry and writing. And so that was fabulous. I really enjoyed that. But, and while I was doing that, I was also working a little side gigs for national parks. So I was a discovery ranger. So particularly during the school holidays, there was lots of work on where we would take tours and show people, you know, we had different tours that we would do, like geology tours and rock platform, you know, what are they called? See, when you get old and older and you go through menopause, you have this brain fog and you can't remember words. Rock pools.
Oh, yes.
Ocean pools, all that sort of stuff. Yep. You know, forests and forest ecosystems. And, of course, I would always talk about my creeks and my rivers. So that was fun. And, yeah, so after I stopped homeschooling and we moved to Canberra, that's when I started with the Canberra Innovation Network. So started back in the STEM field. Oh, yeah, when we first moved to Canberra, that's when I did the travel agency thing. I thought that would be fun. And it kind of was until it wasn't. But again, I learned I can book a good round the world airfare now.
Which is a skill.
Yeah.
And that covers quite a lot of things.
It does. It does.
Not so, everything. Not quite.
No. So it's certainly been, a portfolio career. And I like to say that, even the things that I'm not doing anymore, I certainly learnt a lot. And, working in schools and being a teacher helps when you're trying to develop education programs, because you know what works in a school. You know what a real classroom's like, what kids are engaged with and what they're not. And I'm sure that, even though COVID and everything and technology has changed a little bit in the 10 plus years since I've been a teacher, well, kids are basically still kids, aren't they? So that's been helpful, So I always say that no matter what you do, even if you don't stay with it, it's always helpful. You can always pull something and use the stuff that you've learned.
Is there any advice that you would give younger Ingrid?
Learn how to study.
Specifically career.
learn lots of things, but no, learn how to study and seek out help if you're struggling with whatever it is that in terms of study. But having said that, as long as you're interested in what you're studying and what you're working in, you will find a way. And it might not, certainly won't work out. I would reassure young Ingrid that, it'll work out one way or the other. You might do a couple of side trips. I would also perhaps say, stick to what you know a little bit more, just in terms of, I think I'm okay now and I'll stick with being a coo for a while, I think. But, the side trips have not been helpful financially. I've learnt things, but they certainly haven't helped progress my career in a way that maybe, other people with slightly more linear careers have done. So I wouldn't say you don't have to be linear, but, maybe stay in a rough field, try not to go too. But I don't know. Sometimes unless you try these things, you don't know.
And a lot of energy can be wasted, wondering if that thing could have been for you.
Yeah.
And if you know it's not, then you're not going to waste any energy on it anymore.
I can quite happily say I will never go back and be a travel agent. And I don't think I'll ever go back and be a high school teacher either. I left because I'm homeschooling my kids, but, hats off to teachers, primary and high school. It's only getting harder and harder. So if you've got teachers who love it and can do it, my goodness, hats off to them. They're just amazing people. Teaching is really, really hard.
I like to think people have more of an appreciation of that now.
I think so. Yep.
Back 2019. Thank you so much for sharing. That is such a fascinating and awesome journey. Are there any myths or misconceptions, whether it's about being a COO, career changer, I'm not sure, that you would like to take this opportunity to bust?
I think, if you study geography, you don't have to be a geography teacher. That was a big misconception back in the, there's actually, depending on what aspect of that sort of study you do, there are industry and government jobs out there that you don't necessarily have to go and be a researcher or a teacher. And I think that goes for almost any STEM field that you could imagine. And a lot of the time there's a misconception, certainly in high schools, I think, that there's no jobs in that. What are you going to do? There are jobs in that. If you're good enough and you're patient enough or, do enough homework, there will be jobs in whatever aspect of STEM that you want to pursue. I guess in terms of, now moving into a professional role, and I don't do the STEM, I enable the STEM, there's a map there if that's something that you would consider. And a lot of people do that for work-life balance type reasons, and caregiving responsibilities. They move from academia into professional roles. And I guess the other misconception there I'd like to say is you haven't failed if you leave academia.
Thank you for saying that. I think it's so important for people to hear.
Some of these roles too, it's an admin role, but You could end up doing podcasts, or you could end up, you know, you could work on different events, and, you know, and that might not be fully explained in the job description, but, you know, that, or, you know, the person in charge, I'm like, yeah, if you've got expertise in X, Y, or Z, we'd love to have you on. Yeah, we'd love you to utilize it. That'd be fantastic. So it's worth a phone call, even if it's to say, okay, it's not worth wasting my time on.
We do need to think about wrapping up. So is there anything else you'd like to share that we haven't touched on?
No, I mean, I could give you a whole nother podcast on women in STEM and the barriers that we face, and, you know, and the things that I've learned over the years that, you know, you can either do personally to help yourself to navigate your way through your career, or even, or as you, you know, hopefully get into more managerial or leadership type roles. One of the great things I was able to do or be part of at Astro 3D, or certainly wasn't me by myself, is achieving 50-50 gender equity in the centre. And so, like, I could spend a whole podcast telling you how, what we did to achieve that in 4 years. We went from 38% women researchers to 50%. So, yeah. So, you know, yeah, I've had the opportunity to do lots of cool things that, you know, certainly weren't, I didn't even know they were a career or an opportunity to be able to do when I was, you know, young Ingrid back in high school.
There is like a need for flexibility and plans so that as things come up you don't know about, you can actually take those opportunities.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, yes, maybe I've done that a bit too much. But, you know, you just never know, like, you know, taking those opportunities, you don't know where you're going to end up.
And to wrap up, do you have a shout out or a virtual high five for us? Someone who's doing an awesome job who deserves high fives.
My virtual shout out is to Amanda Caldwell, who put me in touch with you. She is an amazing woman in STEM who's worked with the Chief Scientist and National Youth Science Forum, and I think she's working something now on to do with renewable energy. So again, you know, huge variation in the sorts of things she's been doing, but she does an amazing job and has been a wonderful support to me in navigating Canberra and the STEM environment here, and is always happy just to listen to you have a whinge, even if that's what you need to do. So you need people like that in your life. We all need an Amanda, so Amanda Caldwell.
You do. High five to Amanda, and still doing amazing work out there.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Ingrid. It has been absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and we're really excited to see where Rad Innovate goes.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. So, you know, next 5 years will be really exciting, and who knows where we'll go. Like, I think the plan eventually is to have a national radiation and nuclear science centre. So stay tuned. Might not be me, though. I don't know.
No, well, we won't write it off.
Okay.
Thank you so much, and yeah, good luck.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee, head to avidresearch.com.au, and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.